and welcome to Worlds Apart. Contradiction is a frequently used term to describe the current American stance on many issues, but perhaps nowhere more so than in Washington's relationship with India. Still described by top diplomats as strategically important, it creaks and cracks loudly under the weight of the Trump administration's tariffs. How are the two nations navigating their partnership, and what implications does it hold for the rest of the world? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Asoke Kumar Mukherjee, former permanent representative of India to the United Nations and distinguished fellow of the Vivekananda International Foundation. Ambassador, it's a great honor to talk to you. Thank you very much for being available.
Thank you for inviting me to RT and to your show. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Now, you've given more than 30 years of your life to the diplomatic service, and Indian diplomacy in particular is known for its meticulous and respectful negotiating style. What is it like for India, which has long enjoyed a sort of special treatment in Washington? What is it like for your country to come across somebody like Donald Trump with his abrasive and quite abrupt policy style?
Well, I think for Indian negotiators, negotiating with the United States has a long history. And I think we are at a time of a cycle in our relations with the United States. The cycle started from a high point during the Second World War. It went down from 1954 when the United States started creating military alliances and establishing bases in Asia. It reached its depth in 1971 when the United States aligned itself with Pakistan against the events in East Pakistan, which now is Bangladesh. And then from the 70s till the 1990s, the relationship went through another cycle. There was a period of great friendship during Ronald Reagan, Rajiv Gandhi, 1980s. But in the 1990s, the United States imposed sanctions on India in 1998 after we became a nuclear weapons state. Those sanctions went on till 2009. And after that, the relationship became what you described as a close business-like relationship. But if you study the events in our region and in Asia, it's quite apparent that there is a shift in the priorities of the United States in Asia. And they're going back to the 1950s, to the 1970s, when they preferred to do business with non-democratic or more authoritarian states. And perhaps that creates a problem for their dealings with fellow democracy.
Now, people around the American president describe his style as very frank and direct. And I want to ask you if that's how it's perceived in India. Do you appreciate this as straightforwardness, or do you see that perhaps as being rude, pushy, and a little bit extortionist?
Well, if you look at the first 4 years of President Trump, I think that the relationship between the United States and India was actually on a very stable footing. And Mr. Trump was is a businessman and has the same characteristics of conducting diplomacy as he had at that time. What has changed in the second term of President Trump is that he appears to have now got into the agendas of people who are not necessarily the same as his advisors in the first term. So we are now having to understand and then respond to the new agendas that the president is articulating.
Now, that new agenda includes 50% tariffs, which would be exorbitant for any country, but for a nation of India's size, heritage, and I would add legacy, I assume it's not only about the national economy, but also about national pride. Is that the case? And if so, how do you think it could be solved to the satisfaction of both parties?
When negotiating with the United States on economic issues and their economic interests, we have for a very long time now stood our ground and negotiated through the framework of treaties, of agreements, which give a certain amount of stability and sustainability to negotiations. Right now, we are not in that situation because the announcements out of Washington are unilateral announcements. They have not been made in our WTO framework. They are not being made in any predictable, coherent framework, especially the numbers of 25% and then an additional 25% for importing oil from Russia. They make no economic sense to anybody.
Well, Ambassador, I think it's not only about sheer numbers, but also the style in which the Trump administration is introducing these changes, because in addition to imposing tariffs, the White House also is pressuring India to reduce its energy imports from one specific country, that is Russia, which clearly goes beyond the bilateral framework and some would argue infringes on India's sovereignty. Is it seen that way in New Delhi?
Yes, it is seen that way. And I think that in this, there are two elements which are very important for India. The first is what you mentioned about India's sovereignty. India does not like to be told what to do, like the United States, when it became free from British colonial rule, did not like being told what the British wanted them to do 278 years ago. The second is that the sourcing of energy for India is very closely integrated with India's economic and national security, because we are one of the major importers of energy in the whole world. And mm-hmm. with the size of our economy and population, this is a very huge market. So we would like to exercise our strategic autonomy to buy energy from suppliers who are predictable, reliable, and from whom we can get the energy without conditions.
If I'm not mistaken, India imports about 90% of its crude oil needs. And you mentioned just a moment ago that Indians don't like to be told what to do. And yet there have been some reports from Bloomberg that the current Indian delegation in Washington, who went there to discuss the current trade dispute, reportedly asked the Trump administration to allow it to import oil from Venezuela and Iran, which are also both under the American sanctions. Does this report sound credible to you, that the Indians would actually ask a big daddy in Washington for a permission to do business with third parties?
Well, you are right. And when I worked in the government, I know that this kind of approach, which has been reported by Bloomberg, would never be the official approach of any Indian negotiator. Apart from the fact that we represent a sovereign country, we have also a very strongly ingrained nationalist vision, which drives us, which has driven us from 1947 when we became independent of British colonial rule. So we do not agree to any unilateral measures being imposed on us. And whether it is the Bloomberg report, I think, is part of the disinformation campaign which goes on these days on international affairs and geopolitics. Mm-hmm. And I would therefore be a little skeptical about the veracity of that report.
Now, the U.S. Energy Secretary went public the other day in haranguing India for purchasing Russian oil at a discount. And he also added that the U.S. would be willing to sell its own crude oil to India, albeit perhaps at a higher price. Would that be a good deal for New Delhi, in your opinion?
I think that the price of the oil and the volumes that are contracted for are very important for India's internal economic and political considerations. I cannot see the high volumes that we import being imported at higher prices. We are not like the European Union, who seem to have gone into this kind of deal with the United States. We need oil at market prices, at spot market prices, and our petroleum minister and his officials have been consistently telling and explaining this to the Western media, that we are not doing anybody a favor by buying oil from the spot market.
Now, despite all these unresolved issues, the Trump administration maintains that India remains, quote, a good friend and a partner of the future. And I think Prime Minister Modi seconded that opinion, referring to India and the United States as close friends and natural partners. And I do want to ask you about how this partnership is perceived in New Delhi and whether there are any boundaries, negotiated or explicit, implicit boundaries coming with it. Are there anything that are sort of off limits when it comes to, you know, bilateral relationship for India?
Well, I think there are some understood principles between the two countries. These principles go back to the period when one of our former prime ministers, Mr. Atal Bihari Vajpayee, announced that India and the United States are natural allies. So what made us natural allies were common values. I refer to our common anti-colonial history. We both were British colonies. We both became independent of Britain. So that was a value. Then we were both democracies and pluralistic democracies. And we believe that if this kind of perspective is now coming up in the United States, which wants to push and favor countries and entities which are not democratic, then we need to actually look at what the common values are, which are supposed to bind us, the two of us, into a natural alliance. And this is visible on the ground in the way that terrorism, for example, which is one of the biggest challenges faced by India, it continues to be a target of terrorism, is being dealt with by the United States. I mean, they are mainstreaming terrorist groups, and they do not seem to consider the importance for taking action against terrorism that is being proposed by India consistently. This year, for example, in April, there was a horrible terrorist act in Kashmir, in which 26 people were killed because civilians were killed by these terrorists who came from our neighboring country, Pakistan. And yet the United States is happily welcoming the military leader of Pakistan, who is committed publicly to supporting these terrorist groups. Mm-hmm. So this is something that will have impact on the natural alliance that was proclaimed 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, Ambassador, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
Tell us whether the British were really interested in religion or was this all about politics?
The British wanted to know as much about it as they could. But what they got was not necessarily a truly accurate reflection of the lived reality. It doesn't matter what your religion is as long as the man is good.
I cannot not ask you about the Kerala story, that contentious, controversial movie.
It really was not just propaganda, it was just blatantly false.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Asoke Kumar Mukherjee, former permanent representative of India to the United Nations and distinguished fellow of the Vivekananda International Foundation. Ambassador, just before the break, you mentioned that up until recently, at least, the Indian-American relationship was based on common values. And I think the Indian leadership also counted on sort of traditional diplomacy to bring some continuity and predictability to that relationship after Trump's inauguration, because Prime Minister Modi was among the first foreign leaders to visit the White House, I think, within the 2 weeks of the inauguration. But I'm not sure that calculus is being lived out in reality. How do you think the Trump administration should be sort of handled or leveraged to ensure India's national interest?
Well, I think this is a very important point because for the last 10 or 12 years, our prime minister has consistently pointed to the transformation of India, the development of India, as the biggest priority for India. And we counted on our partnerships with developed countries, especially the United States, to provide us with technology, with financing, partnerships to achieve our goals of development. But in the past year or 2 years, there is a question mark about the commitment of the United States to development as a principle of foreign policy. And that, I think, is the biggest challenge facing India today. Mm-hmm. Because if the United States questions the principle of development and it questions the legal framework agreed to internationally for developing countries, including their right to have higher tariffs, for example, then the entire equation changes. Mm-hmm. And I think we are reaching that point now when the position of the United States on development and on developing countries is going to become a very, very important factor for the future of our international relationship.
Let me ask you specifically about that, because India is one of the states that has long been averse to colonial pressures and dividing the world into two camps. And I think historically, its position has also influenced a lot of smaller nations, especially in the global south. I wonder if the way New Delhi handles this challenge with Washington may provide an example, positive and negative, to other countries in how to deal with this sort of Western arm twisting.
Well, I think yes. And the best example is the COVID pandemic. If you remember, this was the test facing the entire global community. At that time, we in India and other developing countries in the global south wanted international cooperation, including for allowing us to manufacture these vaccines in developing countries which have the infrastructure to manufacture vaccines, like India and South Africa, for example. But this attempt was blocked at the World Trade Organization by the industrialized countries because they held patents, intellectual property right patents, and they wanted to make profits out of selling those vaccines. The consequence was that a large part of the global south, especially in Africa, never received the COVID vaccine. And that has left a very big impact on the entire global south, that instead of joint cooperation, which we were committed to in when adopting the Sustainable Development Goals in 2015, today we are in a polarized world in which might is right, and that is not something that is acceptable to the global south anymore.
Well, it may not be acceptable to the global south, but I think it's very hard to, you know, stand your ground in the face of such a powerful player like the United States using these very aggressive tactics. Now, would it be fair to say that the makeup of the multipolar world as it unfolds before our eyes depends to some extent on how India sorts out this challenge with the Americans, India being as one of the trendsetters or perhaps trailblazers for the global south?
Well, yes, you know, like the United States has a domestic program of Make America Great Again, India too has a domestic program which we call Self-Reliant India, or in Hindi, Atmanirbhar Bharat. Now, our domestic program has got the endorsement of a popularly elected government for the last 12 years. And the priorities of our domestic program are understood by our international partners. For example, Russia is a participant in this program for manufacturing of defense equipment and even for nuclear-related power equipment. So at the moment, it appears to us that the United States is not yet decided to become a partner of countries like India in the Global South, who have their own national development and national transformation programs. We are not able anymore to accept foreign goods at the cost of giving up our own goods. Mm-hmm. And I, as a negotiator, remember this very well from the time of the computer age. In 1986, when President Reagan of the United States agreed to Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi's request for the purchase of the supercomputer. It was made by an American company called Cray. And it was the American system that prevented President Reagan from selling the supercomputer to India. But what did we do? In 1989, we developed our own parallel computing structure called PARA, which was as good as the Cray supercomputer that was denied to us. So this is the experience of India from 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. Today in the Global South, you have more countries who can do similar things. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, the period of imposing might is right and that only one way is the right way has gone. It is a multipolar world today.
Well, and I'm sure you would agree with me, it's easier to stand up to a hegemon when you are partnering with other powerful and self-sufficient nations. I want to ask you specifically about the Indian-Chinese relationship, because even before the introduction of these tariffs, India and China were making some measured reciprocal steps towards each other. Do you think that process may speed up, or do you think perhaps it may be put on hold if the Indians or and the Americans agree on some sort of settlement to the tariff problem?
You know, the India-China relationship is quite unique because both of us are the largest populations in the world. We have this very long land border, and we have a history of exchanges between our peoples, which is very visible when you travel from India to China or from China to India, especially the social linkages of the Buddhist tradition, which have been preserved in China and which are very alive in India too. So we have a lot of things that are in common. We have a problem regarding the demarcation of our common land border, and that is the only problem that we really have, because of which there has been from time to time violent conflict. Mm-hmm. If you look at it in a larger perspective, from the time of China's growth as a modern economic superpower, India and China have partnered each other. It has only been in the last 5 years that there's been a certain deceleration of that cooperation. Mm-hmm. But after the Prime Minister's visit to Shanghai, to China for the Shanghai Cooperation Summit, and the meeting of the representatives responsible for the boundary demarcation issue, there is a reversal and a revival of the momentum between India and China in the economic and people-to-people areas. Mm-hmm. Direct flights have started and visas are being issued and so on. Mm-hmm. So for those who are outside Asia and who look at the India-China relationship as some kind of game in which they will decide who does what, I think that's a wrong reading of the situation. Today, India and China know very well that they require to cooperate and collaborate, mm-hmm, in order to realize their domestic aspirations.
I want to bring up, if I may, one example, very curious example of the Indian-Chinese cooperation in which you personally took part. And I think about a decade ago, you worked with your Chinese colleagues at the United Nations to recognize June 21st as International Yoga Day. And I mention that because this summer, on June 21st, thousands of people across Russia, and I assume, you know, around the world, took their yoga mats out to join free classes in the local parks. And I think that's an example of initiative, you know, taking off not just as a diplomatic undertaking, a bureaucratic undertaking, but also as a sort of living and breathing phenomenon. Are you gratified with the way that project has played out?
Yes, I am, because it has its roots In the first meeting between President Xi Jinping of China and Prime Minister Modi of India in September 2014, that was the first visit of the Chinese president to India. And at that time, there was this school-to-school interaction, which was witnessed by the wife of the Chinese president. And the children were demonstrating the practice of yoga from India and Tai Chi from China. And that gave us the idea, when the Prime Minister of India proposed the International Yoga Day, to reach out to the Chinese in New York. And my Chinese counterpart, the Ambassador Liu Zheyi, he was very positive, and he got the permission from Beijing. And India and China co-sponsored the initiative for the resolution to declare 21st June as the International Yoga Day. So you can imagine the kind of impact that has on the multilateral system when China and India co-sponsor a proposal. And I'm glad that 10 years later, this proposal has not disappeared. And as you said, it has become even more visible across the world, including in countries which did not agree to it in 2015, like Saudi Arabia. But today, yoga is officially recognized in Saudi Arabia. That is amazing.
Amazing, absolutely. Now, yoga is not only a physical practice, but also a mental one that shows, you know, that all the qualities that we hate in others actually reside within us. And through the practice of yoga, you know, people learn to face and deal with those difficult parts of themselves in themselves. And I think that's very applicable to international relations, because many crises or conflicts occur when countries try to evade their internal problems by projecting them onto their, you know, neighbors or onto other countries. And that's despite many pledges or UN resolutions not to do so. I guess my last question to you, why do you think it is so hard to bring a bit more self-discipline, a bit more flexibility and inner strength into international relations?
Well, I think it goes back to where you draw your strength from. And in the case of Indian diplomacy, the strength comes from the concept of the unity of mankind, that all of mankind is united. This was a concept which was proposed during the League of Nations by India, and which became the cementing force of the UNESCO. And the person who proposed it was Dr. Radhakrishnan, an eminent philosopher, but who was also India's ambassador to the former Soviet Union. So it's a very interesting linkage. But the unity of mankind, if you look at the major treaties that have come out after the Second World War, the phrase unity of mankind is there in the most important treaties that have sustained themselves. So this means that in the conduct of diplomacy, you will have to treat your partner, the person opposite you, with the same human perspective with which you view yourself. And if you can put yourself in the other person's shoes, then the chances of your succeeding in diplomacy are higher than if you approach the other person as a non-human person.
Well, Ambassador, I guess perhaps New Delhi needs to send some yoga tutorial to the White House. This way, you know, international politics and the bilateral negotiations might be a bit easier, but we have to leave it there. Thank you very much for sharing your insights with us today.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to have been on your show. Thank you for inviting me.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.